I'm trying to turn off my phone. So once again, it's making a technology. It's driving me crazy. Never mind. I'll just leave it here. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. And I am, I haven't found it necessary to have a drink, nor have I had a drink since January 25th, 1981. So I'm in my 40th year of recovery. I actually came to the Lord on December 25th, 1980, at 3 o'clock in the morning. That is when I surrendered. My surrender date does not match my sobriety date, but every once in a while I share that in AA meetings, but most of the time they may not really understand that. But I think the most important date in my life is December 25th, 1981, when I gave my life to Jesus. You know, we have a Bible study, a men's Bible study, every morning at 7:30, every Thursday morning at 7:30. And I actually go to a meditation meeting now every morning at 6:15. And I think that Bible study, which is one of many Bible studies I go to, I think that's been going on. Woody goes to that Bible study probably for about 60 years. I started going, I guess, in 2000. I've been going for about 20 years to that Bible study. One of the men who used to run that Bible study, Jack McLennan, whenever we would be studying a verse, at the very end he'd say, well, so what's the application of that verse? I mean, what's the application to your life? Which I think is important to see the application. So when I think of, when Woody picks out a psalm or a verse, I'm always thinking in terms of what's the application to my life today? What's the application of Psalm 3 to my life? So in any event, when I was about 9 years sober, I was going through a difficult time. Well, when I say a difficult time, I almost hate to say things like difficult time. I came into AA, as I said, my last trip was this, January 25th, 1981. And I took the program very seriously. And I did the steps. And I did service. And I'm not going to sit here for, you know, a bunch of time and give my bona fides about all the stuff I did. I was into group banquet chairman for 2 years in a row. I did the service. I did the sponsoring. I did step series. I spread the message. I did the deal. When I was about 9 years, and I don't know how many people will identify with this, I've come to realize that one of the reasons AA works is because although we all think we're sort of unique and different, we're actually mostly the same. And what probably happened to me somehow will happen to you or happen to you. So, but all along my AA career, whether it was 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, whatever the time is, I was in a battle. I was in a battle. You remember? I don't know whether there's a few people that are my age here. There used to be a song, and the song was, I fought the law, and the law won. I fought the law, and the law won. Well, listen, I fought the Lord. I fought the Lord, and the Lord won. And we have a line in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that says, for us, there is no middle of the road position. There's no middle of the road solution. In the big book, it says at the end of chapter of the agnostics, it says this sort of thinking, agnostic thinking, which is to me akin to thinking that you can be saved by the things of this world or managing your life instead of throwing all your chips onto God's shoulders. To me, what they say is there is no, they say God either is or he isn't. What's your decision to be? The entire book constantly puts the decision in front of you. Whether it's when they say we honor a new basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We never apologize for God. Or whether it says because of our selfishness and self-centeredness, we must get rid of it or it kills us. God makes that possible. Or when it says, but we won't know you, that may be true. God is in charge of that. So your real reliance must always be on him. He will show you even how to create the fellowship you crave. See to it that your reliance on him is the deal, that you're relying on him. Your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all things will be added unto you. Or if it's in the part of the book where it says, if you want to be rocking in the fourth dimension of existence, know much of heaven and know peace, then the bottom line is, the great fact is simply this, that God must become the central fact of your life. We're convinced that God lives in our hearts and minds in a way which is indeed miraculous. He's doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. Or finally, if it's something like this, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. To me, now, at 71 years of age, after doing this for 39 years, part of me says, after many years of fighting the Lord, part of me says, how could people not see what they're talking about? How could they not see this? But then again, I didn't quite understand it because I'm a middle-of-the-road kind of guy. I'm defiant and I'm stubborn, and I don't even think I did it arrogantly in the sense that I dislike God. I think I wanted the deal. It's just that my natural inclination, my instincts were to fight him. You know, when I went up to my first sponsor and I was 2 months sober and I was telling him that I had no money and I was broke and that I was 2 months behind in the mortgage and I had a wife and a child and I was worried about what was going to happen to me and what would happen to me and what would people think if they foreclosed on my house. When I told him, and let me tell you something, I don't know how many of you have experienced sober fear. I mean, money's not important. It's just right up there with oxygen, you know? I don't know how many of you have ever woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning worrying about paying your bills or worrying about something. I don't know how many people have done that, but I got to tell you something. There is nothing worse than sober fear. And I was scared. When I went up to my sponsor at 2 or 3 months sober and told him about my concerns and my worries, and these were real life worries, and he said to me, I think it's about time you start making coffee for the group. I want to promise you this. I'm not a stupid guy. I graduated the Department of the Honors of Mathematics. I was going for a PhD in algebraic topology. I graduated law school. I mean, I got tons of degrees that tells me I've been educated far beyond my capacity to understand everything. But I can promise you this, okay? When I told him about my money problems, and I knew money would solve my problem, and his answer to me was I needed to start making coffee for the group, I can assure you that it made no sense to me. Zero, zero sense. Like he didn't give me any answer. And yet, and this is probably the only reason I'm here, I followed him over to the coffee pot. And I watched as he showed me how to make the coffee. And the next day, I didn't want to go back because I had no money had come in, and I was even more depressed. But I had to go back because I had to make the coffee. In a sense, that illustration is an illustration of my entire life in AA. Incredible worldly problems. Which gave me great fear of something terrible was going to happen to me. This incredible activity in my brain trying to figure out how to save myself. And on the other hand, following directions to do things that seemed stupid. Following directions of older people telling me to do things that made no sense, whether it was doing the four step or sponsoring. There was always a friction. There was always a fight between the problems of this world and trusting God. The problems of this world and doing God's will. And most of the time, it seemed like they were at odds. You know, one of the things that Jesus said to his disciples before he left the planet, he said, in this world, you will have problems, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. Well, how do you, when you have no money in the bank, and you're worried about your wife and your kid and what people will think about you, how do you overcome that world? And I can promise you, the world I live in, those problems happened at least five times every single day for something. Sometimes it was money. Sometimes it was health. Sometimes it was the way people treated me. Sometimes it could be anything. But I was a man of constant sorrow. I was doing well in AA. I wasn't drinking. You know, I was picking up the medallions. I was picking up the 1 year, the 2 year, the 5 year, the 10 year. But I got to tell you something. All along the way, there were pitfalls. All along the way, there were problems. All along the way, I was doing step series. And let me tell you something, I was grateful. I was relatively happy in AA. But I'll tell you, it was problem after problem. I can tell you this, for at least the first 10 or 15 years, I would never be able to talk about permanent sobriety in the sense of permanent realization of the promises. I know the promises were there. I know there were promises saying that I'm going to lose. You know that promise says I'll lose fear of people and of economic insecurity? You ever hear that promise, I'll lose fear of people and of economic insecurity? I can tell you something. During the first 10 years, every once in a while, that would happen. I don't want you to think I didn't experience that. That's what came to me coming back. But I got to tell you something. That they were like oases in a sea of anxiety. Oases in a sea of anxiety. Many times I was going to meetings not to see whether I could help somebody. Many times I went to meetings for self-preservation because I needed a meeting. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I went through my 10, 15, 20 years of going to meetings because I had to go to a meeting, because I needed a meeting, because I had anxiety, because I had problems. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons I went to meetings is I would feel kind of crummy before the meeting. And what? You ever have one of these deals where you go to a meeting, you feel bad, and then you walk out and you feel good? That ever happened to you? You go to a meeting, you feel bad, you walk out, you feel good. You go to a meeting, you feel bad, you walk out, you feel good. That happened to me almost all the time. Every once in a while I'd hit a bad meeting, if that's possible. But I would go to the meeting and I'd feel bad and I'd walk out and feeling good. But then again, even if I was feeling good, that would last for, you know, that had a short life, a half life. That would last for, you know, an hour or two or five. And then here we are at 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm worried about the money again. I'm worried. I'm trying to figure out how to manage my, you know how it says in the book, we cannot manage our own lives. You know, man, I was constant. I don't know about you. Man, I stopped the drinking, but I didn't stop trying to figure out how to manage my own life. Here's the way I do it. I try to manage my own life. I try to figure out how to manage my own life until it's 4 o'clock in the morning and I haven't been able to get to sleep. And then I get down on my knees and I turn my life over to God. That's how that works, you know? I'll tell you what, it's repeated humiliations and the final crushing of my self-sufficiency. What I was about, and what happens is all these problems I had, although I didn't realize it at the time, you know, the book of James says, rejoice when you have problems, because if you persevere and focus on the Lord throughout these problems, your faith will grow, which is the same thing as saying you'll get a greater conscience, you'll improve your conscious contact with God, which is part of the deal. He will become more and more the central factor of your life. And when God becomes the central factor of your life, when Jesus becomes real and becomes a central fact, and you're no longer, there's no longer this struggle with God or man, you cannot love God and the world. You cannot love God and mammon. You cannot love God and cash. You cannot love God and sex. You cannot love God and romance. You can't love that deal. But of course, when people like us, even though they talk about that in the sixth step, you tell an alcoholic right away that not only has to give up booze, that he's got to give up all the other stuff. You know, who knows how many people would actually stick around. Although in the old days, they were pretty adamant about that stuff, that the Lord had to be the central factor in your life. When I was about 9, so what happens is all along the road, I would run into these people. You know, Bill Wilson said, when you want God enough, he'll show up. And when the pupil's ready, the teacher will appear. And all along my sobriety, when I got to a place where I was stuck, you know what I mean? Because sometimes you get these places where what do they say? You cannot rest on, we rest on our laurels, but we're heading. I would get to a place where I would rest on my laurels. I'd feel comfortable, then a little uncomfortable, then a little more uncomfortable. And I would try to think my way out of it. I would try to figure my way out of it. And you know something? The old meetings weren't doing it. I was going to the meetings. They weren't doing it for me. I was sponsoring the people. They were keeping me physically sober, but they weren't doing it. They weren't lifting me to the next deal. And what would happen is the Lord would put somebody or something in my life. You know how it says, if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain. They would put a man in my life. For me, it was a man in my life. That was somebody that I wanted what they had, and then I would start following them. I would stop figuring it out, and I'd stop following them. And invariably, they would tell me that I was to do something that I didn't want to do. Because I would always tell them I'm doing everything. I would always explain to them I'm doing everything, but it's not working for me. And then they would say, are you going to church? And I'd say, well, no. And they would point out to me that in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, they encourage church membership. They say it twice. And they all went to church. Bill went to church. Bob went to church. He said, we don't make it obligatory on people. You know, when they first come in, it's spiritual kindergarten. But he said, most of us, and we're the founders, we do that deal. You know, so I started going to church. I started going to Bible study. Then I joined the church. Then I became a deacon. Then we started this thing called The Live Again. It's a ministry. It's all over the place, and we have different deals like this. And started going to another Bible study. And on Sunday nights at 6 o'clock, I would go with a gentleman named Pastor Kerry Miller, and my third sponsor, who's passed away, is with the Lord now, John Glenn, and I would lead. I'd lead the worship at the Sunday night traditional Baptist church in Palmetto Bay, Florida, at Christ Fellowship Church, which is interesting when you consider I'm a Jewish kid from Great Neck, Long Island. Yeah, well, go figure that. You know, every once in a while, God wants to hit a hole in one. You know, well, He does say in the Book of Romans, I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it's the power of salvation, first to the Jew and then to the Gentile if we get desperate. So, you know, I mean, it does say that. I hate to bring that up, you know. So one of the things we used to do is used to sing hymns. I happen to be a hymn lover. I'm a lover of hymns. And my favorite hymn, this is one of my favorite, I have a lot of favorite hymns, but this is one of my favorite hymns, is I Love to Tell the Story. And I'm just going to read the first stanza or line of that hymn. I'm not going to sing it. I'll read it to you. And this is what it says. It says, I love to tell the story of unseen things above, of Jesus and His glory, of Jesus and His love. I love to tell the story because I know 'tis true. It satisfies my longings as nothing else can do. I love to tell the story. 'Twill be my theme in glory to tell the old, old story of Jesus and His love.
Amen.
And So in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in Alcoholics Anonymous 3, the story of Bill Dodson, who, if you know anything, if you're in AA, you ever see that portrait of a man on the bed, that's Bill Dodson. He's Alcoholics Anonymous number 3. And they show Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson, and Bill has the Bible in his hand. Because that's what they used between 1935 and 1939, the Bible. And if you read the story, and I'm going to paraphrase it, but it's pretty close to what's in there, Bill Dodson says he says, I was sober, I was physically sober, but I knew there was something more, something I hadn't got, some sort of feeling, some sort of release, something I knew a person ought to have. And I was sitting one day in my house with Bill Wilson and my wife, and we were eating tuna fish sandwiches, and we're having lunch, and I'm trying to figure out by sitting next to Bill Wilson what the heck he had going for him, because he had something more than just not drinking. And then he heard Bill Wilson say this. He said, Bill, let me tell you something. The Lord has been so wonderful to me. The Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I have to keep talking about it and telling other people. And then Bill Dodson says, that line, the Lord has been so wonderful, he says, that's been the golden text for me, because Bill Wilson was very grateful for his sobriety, and he gave all credit to Jesus. He gave all credit to God. And that's been my central deal. And So that's where I am right now. That's where I had 39 years sobriety in my 40th year. I'm at a point in my life where I love to tell the story, and I tell it, of Jesus and his love. I fought the Lord, and the Lord won. You know, there was a line I once told one of my senior pastors, my story, my AA, my drinking, you know, my story, my testimony. And the next week, to my surprise, I told him my story. He gave a sermon on the book of Jonah, and he used my story as an illustration. He didn't use my name. He said I was talking to a gentleman who's a member of this church, and he was telling me his testimony. And, of course, you guys know what the book of Jonah is, and if you don't know, I'll tell you briefly what it is. Jonah was a priest, and God told Jonah, that his will was for Jonah to go to a town called Nineveh, which was, how can I describe Nineveh? It was like Los Angeles. It was like New York. It was like Miami, Florida. He wanted you to go to Nineveh, and I want you to evangelize. I want you to tell them about me and explain to them about salvation. Bring them to the Lord. And Jonah thought about that and said, I think you got the wrong guy. You know, sort of like Moses said, you got the wrong guy. I'm not the guy for that. I'm really the guy you sent to the Crystal Cathedral. I think I'm going to head off to the Vatican. I ain't going off over there. And he got on a ship, and he's traveling over to wherever he's going to, some other place, probably Acapulco or something. And what happens is a big storm comes up, and the sailors are all going to die. And he says to the sailors, look, this is my fault. The Lord told me to go to Nineveh, and I decided to go to the Crystal Cathedral instead. And the Lord is mad at me. He says, throw me overboard, and everything will be okay. And they throw him overboard, and the sea calms down, and God sends a giant fish. They call it a whale, but in the Bible it says a giant fish to swallow Jonah. Jonah's inside the belly of the fish. Now you recognize the story? And he pleads with the Lord. He says, please let me out of the belly of the fish. I'll do anything you want me to do. And the fish vomits up Jonah, and Jonah goes immediately to Nineveh. And, of course, he evangelizes, and everybody comes to God. In true fashion, Jonah's pissed off because he's pissed off that they should come to God, you know, because they don't deserve it or something like that, you know. I think Jonah was one of the first alcoholics. I'm not sure. But in any event, that's me. That's me. That's every one of us. You can either do God's will, or God is going to send the fish after you. The fish is coming, you know? Some of you guys know what it's like to be in the belly of the fish, begging to get out. Let me tell you something. That godly fish is on the way. And so that's me for the last 30 years, having this fish or this hound of heaven chasing after me. So what does this have to do with Psalm 3? So let me tell you why this is the application of this to my life. At the time Psalm 3 was written, what they may not tell you, what they don't tell you, is David had a lot of problems. He had some issues. David had issues. Anybody here ever have issues? King David had some serious issues. Forget about the Bathsheba thing. That was a real bad deal. But for the first part of David's life, King Saul was trying to kill him, was trying to hunt him down to kill him. He was running from Saul, who was trying to kill him because Saul was jealous of him. And then for the next part of his life, his son Absalom, because he had one crazy, let me tell you something, David had one crazy dysfunctional family. And Absalom, his son, got up an army, and Absalom was trying to kill him. So I want you to understand that when David wrote this psalm about all his enemies around him and everybody's trying to kill him, he was running around the planet, hiding from everybody because there were armies out to kill him. His own son was out to kill him. And so this is a psalm where David is praying to the Lord to protect him because he is petrified. He is in a position where he has a reason to be scared. I mean, let me tell you something. The house is being foreclosed on. What are people going to think? They're out to kill him. And he's sitting there and he's throwing himself onto the Lord. Now, I can tell you this. I can identify. You ever go to a meeting or something like that and somebody gives a testimony and you say, "You're telling my story"? Or you say, "I can identify with you"? I know what it's like to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and think, "This is it. God saved me a million times, but he ain't saved me from this one. This is it. My career is over. This is it. They're going to finally find out about me. This is it. They're all talking about me. I know they're all laughing about me. This is it. I did the worst. This is it. I'll never be able to do this. I'll never be able to speak at this convention. This, I just gave the worst AA talk in the world. This is it." I can tell you thousands of times I was scared out of my mind, petrified, and no, and you want to know something? No meeting would help. Nothing would. You know what the meetings would do? It would stop me from drinking. You know what sponsoring people would help you? It would stop me from drinking. But you know something? After I sponsored the guy, after I spoke to the person, after I spoke to my sponsor, after I left the group at 3 o'clock in the morning, the fear was still there. The fear. You ever have a situation where you're doing AA and you're doing everything and you're calling up people and you're telling them how you feel and they're saying shit like, "Oh, don't worry, you'll be okay." You know what I mean? And it's nice you're talking to them, but you know in your mind you ain't going to be okay because they don't get it. Your life is over. And there's nobody you can talk to because everybody you talk to, they're going to say things like pray on it or do this on it or do that on it. And you're looking at them like they have no clue. Don't you understand? I'm going to die here. And nothing's helping me. The me, and I can't tell this meeting and I can't tell this person. And you've got, let me tell you something, that's the story of my AA life. That's the story of, and you know something? It gets worse as you get older in AA. Because when you're new and you got 3 months, all you do is vomit on people. It's, you're allowed to vomit on people. That's why they call them pigeons, because they shit all over you. You're allowed to go into a room and say, "I'm in love with a camel. I'm in love with a camel." It doesn't matter. Three guys get up, they buy you a cup of coffee, and they say that they too were in love with camels. It doesn't matter. They don't care. You know, they love on you. But I'll tell you what, you have 10 years or 15 years, you start talking about how you're in love with a camel, they crucify you in alcohol. They'll kill you. You know what I mean? You have no business whining at your with your tongue. And listen, I know what it's like out of pride and ego to be dying inside, but you can't tell anybody at the meeting because you're doing the damn steps there that night. You know, because you're the one who's doing the steps at the meeting, and now you're going to tell them, listen, I just want you to know I'm thinking of killing myself. You know, it's not, it doesn't work, okay? But here's what happens. What happens is, at 3 o'clock in the morning, oh, I just lost you guys. I don't know whether you lost me. Can you still hear me?
Yes, and see you.
Oh, yeah, you came
yes,
back.
I can hear you.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what happens. At 3 o'clock in the morning, you know what happens? I get down on my knees. Maybe I read the Bible. Maybe I read the big book. I get down on my knees, and I do the Psalm I do the Psalm 3 thing. I do the Psalm 3. It may not be the Psalm 3 thing. It may be the 23rd Psalm. It may be some other Psalm. It may be some other prayer. But I get down on my knees, and I give up the ghost, and I get serious. I get serious about this deal. And I'll tell you what it says in the big book. I'll actually read it to you, what it says in the big book. And this is the application. It's in how it works. This is about that point in time that I wish I had marked it. Where it says, we never, let me see. It says, we never apologize for God. Let me see where I can find that. If anybody knows where it is. Here it is. This is page 68. Perhaps we think there is a better way. We think so. If we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in a world to play the role he assigns just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him. Does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness, paradoxically is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Now listen to this part. Listen to this part. Instead, we let him demonstrate to us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be at once. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. That's the good news. Now, here's the bad news. And I'm just telling you this based upon my experience and the experience I've had watching other people. I know it sounds good. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. That doesn't happen after 5 years. That doesn't happen after 10 years. That doesn't happen after 15 or 20 years. It takes a long time to get to the point where God becomes the centerpiece of your life and you vote. Let me tell you something. I don't know if you're anything like me and I was doing this thing. You're gonna be battling, your mind is gonna be forcing you to battle the desire to try to figure it out yourself. Before you give it to God, you're gonna be 5 miles into trying to manage the problem and realize that you're dead meat before you finally get on your knees. Let me tell you something. The last thing you want to do is give it to God. You just don't trust him. I know it says we're on a new basis of trusting in God. Let me tell you something. The basis you're on is trusting to God when all else fails. You're going to trust yourself. You're going to trust your own brain first. You ain't giving up anything to God just in case God decides that you're not going to get the car. You know, you don't want to leave it up to him. And it takes many, many years of practice and doing this. Let me tell you something. You know what the big book says? Repeated humiliation. First of all, you got to get to the point. You got to get to the 6-step point where you become entirely ready to give up the ghost. Give up all that stuff. Give it all up. And secondly, it says you've got to learn the value of suffering and go through repeated humiliations and the final crushing of your self-sufficiency before you start getting this thing. There's a lot of surrenders. There's more than one surrender. In order to get in here, you surrender. There's more surrenders. In chat, I put this great line. I love this line because it's so true. And this is what the line says. It's actually from the Oxford group. I'm reading a book on the 8 points of the Oxford group now. It says, truly, a man may look at a thing 999 times and not see it once, and then look for the 1,000th time and see it for the first time. You have no idea, or maybe you do, you probably do, of how many people I run into who had 15 years sobriety, 20 years sobriety. They're in, they're out. I had one guy who had 17 years sobriety, and then he came back in. Now he has another 17 years. Where all of a sudden, after all this time in A, all of a sudden, they see the deal. All of a sudden, like they say, I don't understand why I didn't see this thing. Why they didn't get this, but now they see it. It's like a whole different, it's like they're reborn. It's like a whole different thing, the way they see the world and their place in the world. That's an exciting thing to see. I like recognize it. You can recognize when somebody's just sort of doing this thing by rote or because they have to do it. And somebody who, like, all of a sudden their eyes are wide, they're opened up, they're excited, they're saying, I can't believe I didn't see this deal. I didn't see this thing. And now I see it. And there's a lot of things that happen to me and that will happen to you if you keep on doing this thing in God's time. So it's all about letting God into your life and making him the central fact so you don't have to be scared. You don't have to be scared of Absalom coming at you and all this other stuff. So that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.